This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Roadside Picnic by Arkady and Boris Strugatsky. Translated by Olena Bormashenko. Read for you by Robert Forster. With Fred Sanders.
Goodness. You gotta make it out of badness. Because there isn't anything else to make it out of. Robert Penn Warren. An excerpt from an interview with Dr. Valentine Pillman by a correspondent from Harmont Radio after the former received the 19-something Nobel Prize in Physics. Interviewer. I suppose that your first important discovery, Dr. Pillman, was the celebrated Pillman Radiant. Dr. Pillman. I wouldn't say so. The Pillman Radiant wasn't my first discovery. It wasn't important, and strictly speaking, it wasn't a discovery. It's not entirely mine, either. Doctor, you must be joking. Everyone knows about the Pillman Radiant, even school children. That's no surprise. As a matter of fact, it was discovered by a schoolboy. I'd tell you his name, but unfortunately it has slipped my mind. Take a look at Stetson's History of the Visit. He's an excellent source on the subject. Yes, the radiant was discovered by a schoolboy. The coordinates were published by a college student, and yet it was named after me. Ah, yes, you never can tell who'll get the credit for a discovery. Dr. Pillman, could you please explain to our listeners? Of course. The Pillman radiant is really very simple. Imagine taking a large globe, giving it a good spin, then firing a few rounds at it. The bullet holes on the globe would fall on a certain smooth curve. The crux of my so-called important discovery is the following simple observation. All six visit zones are positioned on the surface of the planet like bullet holes made by a gun located somewhere between Earth and Deneb. Deneb is the alpha star of Cygnus, while the Pillman Radiant is just our name for the point in space from which, so to speak, the shots were fired. Thank you, Doctor. Dear listeners, finally, a clear explanation of the Pillman Radiant. By the way, the day before yesterday was the 13th anniversary of the visit. Would you like to say a couple of words on the subject? What would your listeners like to know? Keep in mind, I wasn't in Harmont at the time. That makes us all the more interested in what you thought when you heard that your hometown was invaded by a highly advanced alien civilization. To be honest, at first I assumed it was a hoax. I couldn't imagine anything like that happening in our little town. Western Siberia, Uganda, the South Atlantic. Even those seemed possible, but Harmont? But eventually you had to believe. Eventually, yes. And then? I suddenly realized that Harmont and the other five zones, we only knew about four at the time. I noticed that they lay on a very smooth curve. So I calculated the coordinates of the radiant and sent it to nature. And you weren't at all worried about the fate of your hometown. Well, by then I believed in the visit, but I simply couldn't force myself to swallow the hysterical articles about burning neighborhoods, monsters that devoured exclusively women and children, and bloody struggles between the invincible aliens and the doomed yet heroic units of the Royal Armored Corps. I have to admit, you were right. Our fellow journalists sure made a mess of things, but let us return to science. Have you made other discoveries related to the visit? Was the Pillman Radiant the first of many? It was my first and last discovery. But you've probably been carefully following the progress of international research in the visit zones. Yes, I periodically flip through the reports. You mean the reports of the International Institute of Extraterrestrial Cultures? Yes. And what, in your opinion, is the most important discovery of the last 13 years? The fact of the visit. Pardon me? The fact of the visit is not only the most important discovery of the last 13 years, it's the most important discovery in human history. It doesn't matter who these aliens were, it doesn't matter where they came from, why they came, or why they left so quickly, or where they vanished to since. What matters is that we now know for sure humanity is not alone in the universe. I'm afraid the Institute of Extraterrestrial Cultures could never make a more fundamental discovery. That's incredibly interesting, Dr. Pillman, but actually I was referring to technological discoveries, discoveries that our Earth engineers can use. After all, many distinguished scientists believe that the items we found could completely change the course of human history. I'm afraid I don't belong to their number, and I'm not an expert on specific discoveries. But for the last 2 years, you've acted as a consultant to the UN Commission on the problems of the visit. That's correct. But I'm not involved in the research on extraterrestrial culture. As a consultant, I, along with my colleagues, represent the international scientific community on decisions about the internationalization of the visit zones. Roughly speaking, we make sure that no one outside the International Institute gets access to the alien marvels discovered in the zones. Why? Are there others with designs on them? Yes. You probably mean stalkers. I'm not familiar with the term. That's what the residents of Harmont call the desperate young men who, despite the grave risks, sneak into the zone and smuggle out whatever they find. It's quite the new career. Oh, I see. No, that's outside our area of expertise. Of course, that's police work. Out of curiosity, what exactly is within your area of expertise, Dr. Pillman? There's a constant leak of materials from the visit zones into the hands of irresponsible people and organizations. We deal with the consequences of such leaks. Doctor, could you be a little more specific? Wouldn't you rather move on to the arts? Aren't your listeners interested in my opinion about the beautiful Godi Müller? Of course, but first let's finish up with science. Aren't you, as a scientist, tempted to study these alien treasures yourself? Hard question. I suppose I am. So, there's a chance that one day we'll see you back on the streets of your hometown? Perhaps.
Chapter 1. Redrick Schuhart, 23 years old, single, laboratory assistant in the Harmont branch of the International Institute of Extraterrestrial Cultures. The other day we're standing in the repository. It's evening already. Nothing left to do but dump the lab suits. Then I can head down to the Borscht for my daily dose of booze. I'm relaxing, leaning on the wall, my work all done, and a cigarette at the ready, dying for a smoke. I haven't smoked for 2 hours. Well, he keeps fiddling with his treasures. One safe is loaded, locked, and sealed shut, and he's loading yet another one, taking the empties from our transporter, inspecting each one from every angle, and they are heavy bastards, by the way, 14 pounds each, and, grunting slightly, carefully depositing them on the shelf. He's been struggling with these empties for ages, and all, in my opinion, with no benefit to humanity or himself. In his place, I would have bailed a long time ago and gotten another job with the same pay. Although, on the other hand, if you think about it, an empty really is a puzzling and even a mysterious thing. I've handled them lots of times myself, but every time I see one, I can't help it, I'm still amazed. It's just these two copper discs, the size of a saucer, a quarter inch thick, about 18 inches apart, and not a thing between the two. I mean nothing whatsoever, zip, nada, zilch. You can stick your hand between them. Maybe even your head, if the thing has unhinged you enough. Nothing but empty space, thin air. And despite this, There must be something there, a force field of some sort, because so far, no one's managed to push these discs together, or pull them apart either. No, friends, it's hard to describe this thing if you haven't seen one. It looks much too simple, especially when you finally convince yourself that your eyes aren't playing tricks on you. It's like describing a glass to someone, or, God forbid, a wine glass. You just wiggle your fingers in the air and curse in utter frustration. All right, we'll assume that you got it, and if you didn't, pick up a copy of the Institute's reports. They have articles about these empties in every issue, complete with pictures. Anyway, Kirill's been struggling with these empties for almost a year now. I've worked for him from the very beginning, but I still don't get what he wants with them, and to be honest, I haven't tried too hard to find out. Let him first figure it out for himself, sort it all out, then maybe I'll have a listen. But so far, one thing is clear to me. He's absolutely determined to dismantle an empty, dissolve it in acid, crush it under a press, or melt it in an oven. And then he'll finally get it. He'll be covered in glory, and the entire scientific world will simply shudder in pleasure. But for now, as far as I know, he's nowhere near this goal. He hasn't yet accomplished anything at all, except that he's exhausted himself, turned gray and quiet, and his eyes have become like a sick dog's. They even water. If it were someone else, I'd get him totally wasted, take him to a great girl to loosen him up a bit. Then, the next morning, I'd feed him more booze, take him to more girls, and by the end of the week, he'd be A-okay, good as new, ready to go. Except this sort of therapy wouldn't work on Kirill. There's no point in even suggesting it. He's not the type. So, as I said, we're standing in the repository. I'm looking at him, the way he's gotten, how his eyes have sunk in, and I feel sorrier for him than I can say. And then I decide, except I don't really decide. It's like the words tumble out themselves. Listen, I say, Kirill. He's standing there holding up the last empty and looking like he wants to crawl right inside it. Listen, I say, Kirill, what if you had a full empty, huh? A full empty, he repeats, knitting his brows like I'm speaking Greek. Yeah, I say. It's your hydromagnetic trap. What's it called? Object 77B, only with some shit inside, blue stuff. I can tell. I'm starting to get through. He looks up at me, squints, and there in his eyes, behind the dog tears, appears a glimmer of intelligence, as he himself loves to put it. Wait, wait, he says. A full one. The same thing except full. Yes, exactly. Where? My Kirill's cured. Good as new and ready to go. Let's go have a smoke, I say. He promptly stuffs the empty into the safe, slams the door, gives the lock 3.5 turns, and comes back with me to the lab. For an empty, Ernest would give $400 in cash, and I could bleed the bastard dry for a full one, but believe it or not, that doesn't even cross my mind, because in my hands, Kirill has come to life again. He's buzzing with energy, almost bursting into song, bounding down the stairs 4 at a time, not letting a guy light his cigarette. Anyway, I tell him everything, what it looks like and where it is and how to best get at it. He immediately takes out a map, finds the garage, puts his finger on it, gives me a long look, and of course immediately figures me out. But then that isn't so hard. You devil red, he says, smiling at me. Well, let's get this over with. We'll go first thing tomorrow morning. I'll request a hover boat and pass at 9, and by 10 we'll be off, all right? All right, I say. And who else will we take? What do we need another guy for? No way, I say. This is no picnic. What if something happens to you? It's the zone. Got to follow the rules. He gives a short laugh and shrugs. Up to you. You know better. No shit. Of course, that was him being generous. Who needs another guy? We'll go by ourselves. We'll keep the whole thing dark, and no one will suspect a thing, except I know that the guys from the Institute don't go into the zone in pairs. They have an unwritten rule around here. Two guys do all the work while the third one watches. And when they ask later, he vouches there was no funny business. If it were up to me, I'd take Austin, Kirill says, but you probably don't want him. Or would he do? No, I say. Anyone but him. You'll take Austin another time. Austin isn't a bad guy. He's got the right mix of courage and cowardice, but I think he's already doomed. You can't explain this to Kirill, but I know these things. The man has decided he's got the zone completely figured out, and so he'll soon screw up and kick the bucket. He can go right ahead, but not with me around. All right, says Kirill. How about Tender? Tender is his second lab assistant. He isn't a bad guy. A calm sort. He's a bit old, I say, and he has kids. That's okay. He's been in the zone already. Fine, I say. Let it be Tender. Anyway, he stays there poring over the map while I race straight to the Borscht, because my stomach is growling and my throat is parched. The next day, I get to work at 9, as usual, and show my ID. The guard on duty is the beefy sergeant I pummeled last year when he made a drunken pass at Gouda. Hey, he says, they're looking all over the Institute for you, Red. I interrupt him politely. I'm not Red to you, I say. Don't you try to pal around with me, you Swedish ape. For God's sake, Red, he says in astonishment. But they all call you that. I'm anxious about going into the zone and cold sober to boot. I grab him by the shoulder belt and I tell him exactly what he is and how his mother conceived him. He spits on the floor, returns my ID, and continues without any more pleasantries. Redrick Schuhart, he says, you are ordered to immediately report to the chief of security, Captain Herzog. There you go, I say. Much better. Keep plugging away, Sergeant. You'll make lieutenant yet. Meantime, I'm shitting my pants. What could Captain Herzog want from me during work hours? Well, off I go to report. He has an office on the third floor, a very nice office, complete with bars on the windows like a police station. Willie himself is sitting behind the desk, puffing on his pipe and typing some gibberish on his typewriter. Over in the corner, some sergeant is rummaging through a metal cabinet. Must be a new guy. I've never met him. They have more of these sergeants at the Institute than they have at division headquarters, all of them hale, hearty, and rosy-cheeked. They don't need to go into the zone and don't give a damn about world affairs. Hello, I say. You requested my presence? Willie looks at me like I'm not there, pushes away his typewriter, puts an enormous file in front of him, and starts flipping through it. Redrick Schuhart, he says. That's my name, I answer, feeling an urge to burst into nervous laughter. How long have you worked at the Institute? 2 years, going on the third. Your family? I'm all alone, I say. An orphan. Then he turns to the sergeant and orders him sternly. Sergeant Loomer, go to the archives and bring back case 150. The sergeant salutes him and beats it. Willie slams the file shut and asks me gloomily, starting up your old tricks again, are you? What old tricks? You know damn well what old tricks. We've received information on you again. Ah, I think. And who was the source? He scowls and bangs his pipe on the ashtray in annoyance. It's none of your business, he says. I'm warning you, as an old friend. Give up this nonsense. Give it up for good. If they catch you a second time, you won't walk away with 6 months. And they'll kick you out of the Institute once and for all. Understand? I understand, I say. That much I understand. What I don't understand is what son of a bitch squealed on me. But he's staring through me again, puffing on his empty pipe and flipping merrily through his file. That, then, signals the return of Sergeant Loomer with case 150. Thank you, Schuhart, says Captain Willie Herzog, nicknamed the Hog. That's all I needed to know. You are free to go. Well, I go to the locker room, change into my lab suit, and light up the entire time trying to figure out where are they getting the dirt. If it's from the Institute, then it's all lies. No one here knows a damn thing about me and never could. And if it's from the police, again, what could they know about me except my old sins? Maybe the vulture got nabbed. Bastard, to save his sorry ass, would rat on his own mother, but even the vulture doesn't have a thing on me nowadays. I think and think. I can't think of a thing and decide not to give a damn. Last time I went into the zone at night was 3 months ago. The swag is mostly gone, and the money is mostly spent. They didn't catch me then, and like hell they'll catch me now. I'm slippery. But then as I'm heading upstairs, it hits me, and I'm so stunned that I go back down to the locker room, sit down, and light up again. It turns out I can't go into the zone today. And tomorrow I can't. And the day after tomorrow, it turns out the cops again have me on their radar. They haven't forgotten about me, and even if they have, someone has very kindly reminded them. It doesn't even matter now who it was. No stalker, unless he's completely nuts, will go anywhere near the zone when he knows he's being watched. Right now, I ought to be burrowing into some deep, dark corner. Zone? What zone? I haven't set foot there in months. I don't even go there using my pass. What are you harassing an honest lab assistant for? I think all this through and even feel a bit of relief that I don't need to go into the zone today. Except how am I going to break it to Kirill? I tell him straight out, I'm not going into the zone. Your orders? At first, of course, he just gawks at me. Eventually something seems to click. He takes me by the elbow, leads me to his office, sits me down at his table, and perches on the windowsill nearby. We light up. Silence. Then he asked me cautiously, Red, did something happen? Now what am I supposed to tell him? No, I say, nothing happened. Well, I blew $20 last night playing poker. That Noonan sure knows how to play, the bastard. Hold on, he says. What? You mean you just changed your mind? I almost groan from the tension. I can't, I say through my teeth. I can't. You get it? Herzog just called me to his office. He goes limp. Again, misery is stamped on his face, and again his eyes look like a sick poodle's. He takes a ragged breath, lights a new cigarette with the remains of the old one, and says quietly, Believe me, Red, I didn't breathe a word to anyone. Stop it, I say. Who's talking about you? I haven't even told Tender yet. I got a pass for him, but I haven't even asked him whether he'd come or not. I keep smoking in silence. Ye gods, a man just doesn't understand. What did Herzog say to you, anyway? Oh, not much, I say. Someone squealed on me, that's all. He gives me a funny look, hops off the windowsill, and starts walking back and forth. He's pacing around his office while I sit there, blowing smoke rings and keeping my trap shut. I feel sorry for him, of course, and really, this is rotten luck. A great cure I found for the guy's depression. And who's to blame here? I am, that's who. I tempted a child with candy, except the candy's in a jar, out of reach, on the top shelf. He stops pacing, comes to me, and looking somewhere off to the side, he asks awkwardly, Listen, Red, how much would it cost? A full empty. I don't get it at first, thinking he wants to buy one somewhere else. Except good luck finding another one. It might be the only one in the world. And besides, he wouldn't have enough money. Where would a Russian scientist get that much cash? Then I feel like I've been slapped. Does the bastard think I'm pulling this stunt for the dough? For God's sake, I think, asshole, what do you take me for? I even open my mouth, ready to shower him with curses, and I stop. Because actually, what else could he take me for? A stalker's a stalker. The money is all that matters to him. He gambles his life for the money. So it follows that yesterday I threw out the line, and today I'm working the bait, jacking up the price. These thoughts shock me speechless. Meanwhile, he keeps staring at me intently, and in his eyes I don't see contempt, only a kind of compassion. And so I explain it to him calmly. No one has ever gone to the garage with a pass, I say. They haven't even laid the route to it yet. You know that. So here we are coming back, and your tender starts bragging how we made straight for the garage, took what we needed, and returned immediately. As if we went to the warehouse, and it will be perfectly obvious, I say, that we knew what we were coming for. That means that someone was guiding us, and which one of the three it was, that's a real tough one. You understand how this looks for me? I finish my little speech, and we silently look at each other in the eye. Then he suddenly claps his hands, rubs them together, and cheerfully announces, "Well, of course, no means no. I understand you, Red. So I can't judge you. I'll go myself. I'll manage, with luck. Not my first time." He spreads the map on the windowsill, leans on his hands, hunches over it, and all his good cheer evaporates before my eyes. I hear him mumble, 390 feet, or even 400. A bit more to the garage. No, I won't take Tender. What do you think, Red? Maybe I shouldn't take Tender. He has two kids, after all. They won't let you out on your own, I say. Don't worry, they will, he says, still mumbling. I know all the sergeants and all the lieutenants. I don't like those trucks. 13 years they've stood in open air, and they still look brand new. 20 steps away, the gasoline tanker is rusted through, but they look fresh from the assembly line. Oh, that zone. He lifts his gaze from the map and stares out the window, and I stare out the window, too. There beyond the thick leaded glass is our zone, right there, almost within reach, tiny and toy-like from the 13th floor. If you take a quick look at it, everything seems okay. The sun shines there just like it's supposed to, and it seems as if nothing's changed, as if everything's the same as 13 years ago. My old man, rest his soul, could take a look and see nothing's out of place. Might only wonder why there isn't smoke coming from the factories. Is there a strike on? Yellow ore in conical mounds, blast furnaces gleaming in the sun, rails, rails, and more rails on the rails of a locomotive. In short, the typical industrial landscape, except there's no one around. No one living. No one dead. Ah, and there's the garage, a long gray tube, the gates wide open, and trucks standing next to it on the lot. 13 years they've stood, and nothing's happened to them. Kirill got that right. He has a good head on his shoulders. God help you, if you ever pass between those vehicles, you must always go around. There's a useful crack in the pavement there, if it hasn't filled with brambles. 400 feet. Where is he measuring that from? Oh, must be from the last marker, right? Can't be more than that from there. These eggheads are making progress after all. Look, they've laid a route all the way to the dump. And a clever route at that. There it is, the ditch where Slug kicked the bucket, all 6 feet away from their route. And Knuckles kept telling the Slug, "You idiot, stay away from those ditches, or there will be nothing left to bury." A real prophecy that was. Nothing left to bury indeed. That's the zone for you. Come back with swag, a miracle. Come back alive, success. Come back with a patrol bullet in your ass, good luck, and everything else, that's fate. I take a look at Kirill and see that he's watching me out of the corner of his eye, and the look on his face makes me do another 180. Screw them, I think. Let them all rot in hell. What can those toads do to me, after all? He doesn't need to say a thing, but he does. "Laboratory Assistant Schuhart," he says. "From official, I emphasize official, sources, I have received information suggesting that the inspection of the garage may be of great value to world science. I propose we inspect the garage. A bonus paycheck is guaranteed." And he's grinning from ear to ear. "What official sources?" I ask, grinning like an idiot myself. "These are confidential sources," he answers. "But I'm authorized to tell you," here he stops grinning and frowns, "say, from Dr. Douglas." "Ah," I say, "from Dr. Douglas. And which Dr. Douglas is that?" "Sam Douglas," he says dryly. "He perished last year." My skin crawls. For God's sake, who talks about these things before setting out? These eggheads never have a grain of sense. I jab my cigarette butt into the ashtray. Fine. Where's your tender? How long do we have to wait for him? Anyway, we drop the topic. Kirill calls PPS and orders us a hover boat while I take a look at their map. That's not bad at all. Made from a highly magnified aerial photograph. You can even make out the ridges on the tire lying next to the garage gates. If we stalkers had maps like this, then again, much good it'd do at night when you're showing your ass to the stars and can't see your own two hands. And here Tender shows up, red in the face, puffing and panting. His daughter got sick. He had to go fetch the doctor. He apologizes for being late. Well, we hand him quite the gift, a trip to the zone. At first he almost forgets to puff and pant, the poor guy. "What do you mean, the zone?" he says. "Why me?" However, when he hears about the double bonus and that Red Shoehart is coming too, he calms down and starts breathing again. Anyway, we go down to the boudoir. Kirill rushes off to get the passes. We show the passes to yet another sergeant, and this sergeant gives each of us a spec suit. Now, these really are handy. Dye a spec suit any color other than the original red, and any stalker would put down $500 for it without batting an eyelash. I've long since vowed to figure out a way to swipe one from the Institute. At first glance, it's nothing special. Looks like a diving suit with a helmet to match and a large visor at the front. Maybe it's not quite like a diving suit. Actually, more like a space suit. It's light, comfortable, not too tight, and you don't sweat in it from the heat. You can go right through a fire in this thing, and no gas will penetrate it. It's even bulletproof, they say. Of course, fire, toxic gas, and bullets, these are only earth perils. The zone doesn't have those. In the zone, you have other worries. Anyhow, truth be told, even in their spec suits, people drop like flies. On the other hand, without them, it'd probably be even worse. These suits are completely safe from the burning fuzz, for example, and from Satan's blossom and its spit. All right. We pull on our spec suits. I pour some nuts and bolts from a bag into my hip pocket, and we plod across the Institute yard toward the zone entrance. That's how they always do it around here, so that everyone can see. There they go, the heroes of science, to lay themselves down on the altar to mankind, knowledge and the Holy Spirit. Amen. And sure enough, sympathetic mugs poke out of every window all the way to the 15th floor, hankies waving goodbye, and an orchestra are the only things missing. "Keep your head high," I tell Tender. "Suck in your gut, soldier. A grateful humanity won't forget you." He gives me a look, and I see that he's in no mood for jokes. He's right. This is no joke. But when you're leaving for the zone, it's one of two things. You start bawling, or you crack jokes. And I'm sure as hell not crying. I take a look at Kirill. He's holding up okay, only mouthing something silently, as if praying. "Praying?" I ask. "Pray, pray, the farther into the zone, the closer to heaven." "What?" he says. "Pray," I yell. "Stalkers cut in line at the gates of heaven." And he suddenly smiles and pats me on the back as if to say, "Nothing will happen as long as you are with me, and if it does, well, we only die once." God, he's a funny guy. We hand our passes over to the last sergeant. This time, for a change of pace, he happens to be a lieutenant. I know him. His pop sells cemetery fencing in Rexopolis. And there's the hover boat waiting for us. The guys from PPS have flown it over and left it at the checkpoint. Everyone is gathered already, the ambulance and the firefighters and our valiant guards, the fearless rescuers. Bunch of overfed slackers with their helicopter. Wish to God I'd never set eyes on them. We climb into the boot. Kirill takes the controls and looks at me. "Well, Red," he says, "your orders?" I slowly lower the spec suit zipper on my chest, pull out a flask, take a long sip, screw the lid back on, and put the flask back. I can't do without this. God knows how many times I've been in the zone, but without it, no way. Can't do it. They're both looking at me and waiting. All right, I say. I'm not offering you any since this is our first time going in together and I don't know how the stuff affects you. Here's how we'll do things. Everything I say will be carried out immediately and unconditionally. If someone hesitates or starts asking questions, I'll hit whatever is in reach, my apologies in advance. For example, say I order you, Mr. Tender, to walk on your hands. And at that very moment, you, Mr. Tender, must stick your fat ass up in the air and do as you are told. And if you don't do as you're told, you may never see your sick daughter again. Got it? But I'll take care that you do see her. Just don't forget to give the orders, Red, croaks Tender, who is completely red, sweating already and smacking his lips. I'll walk on my teeth, never mind my hands. I'm no novice. You are both novices to me, I say. And I won't forget the orders, don't you worry. Oh, just in case, do you know how to drive a boot? He knows how, says Kirill. He's good at it. Glad to hear, I say. And we're off. Lower your visors. Low speed along the mark route, altitude 9 feet. At the 27th marker, stop. Kirill lifts the boot to 9 feet and puts it in low gear while I discreetly turn my head and blow over my left shoulder for luck. Looking back, I see our guards, the rescuers, are clambering into their helicopter. The firefighters are standing up in respect. The lieutenant at the door of the checkpoint is saluting us, the idiot. And above them all, an intense banner, already faded, "Welcome to Earth, dear aliens." Tender made a move to wave them all goodbye, but I gave him a sharp nudge in the ribs to knock the ceremonies out of him. I'll show you how to bid farewell, you fat-ass fool. We're off. To the right of us, the Institute. To the left, the Plague Quarter. And we're gliding from marker to marker down the middle of the street. Lord, it's been a while since anyone walked or driven here. The pavement's all cracked. Grass has grown through the crevices, but here, at least, it's still our human grass. On the sidewalk to the left, the black brambles begin, and from this we see how well the zone sets itself apart. The black thicket along the road looks almost mowed. No, these aliens must have been decent guys. They left a hell of a mess, of course, but at least they put clear bounds on their crap. Even the burning fuzz doesn't make it over to our side, though you'd think the wind would carry it around all four directions. The houses in the Plague Quarter are peeling and lifeless, but the windows are mostly intact, only so dirty that they look opaque. Now, at night, when you crawl by, you can see the glow inside, as if alcohol were burning in bluish tongues. That's the hell slime radiating from the basement. But mostly it looks like an ordinary neighborhood with ordinary houses, nothing special about it except that there are no people around. By the way, in this brick building over here lived our math teacher, the Kama. He was a pain in the ass and a loser. His second wife left him right before the visit, and his daughter had a cataract in one eye. I remember we used to tease her to tears. During the initial panic, he ran in nothing but underwear all the way to the bridge, like his neighbors. Ran for 4 miles, nonstop. After that, he got a bad case of the plague, which peeled his skin and nails right off. Almost everyone who lived here got the plague. A few died, mostly old folks, and not all of them either. I, for one, think it wasn't the plague that did them in, but sheer terror. Now, in those three neighborhoods over there, people went blind. That's what people call them nowadays, the first blind quarter, the second blind quarter. They didn't go completely blind, but rather got something resembling night blindness. Strangely, they say they weren't blinded by a flash of light, though it said there were some bright flashes, but by an awful noise. It thundered so loudly, they say, that they instantly went blind. Doctors tell them that's impossible. You can't be remembering right. No, they insist. There was loud thunder from which they went blind. And by the way, no one else heard any thunder at all. Yeah, looks like nothing happened here. That glass kiosk over there doesn't have a single scratch on it. And look at that stroller near the gates. Even the linen in it looks clean. Only the TV antennas give the place away. They're overgrown with wispy hairs. Our eggheads have long been hankering after these antennas. They'd like to know, you see, what this hair is. We don't have it anywhere else, only in the plague quarter, and only on the antennas. But most important, it's right here, beneath our very own windows. Last year they got an idea, lowered an anchor from a helicopter and hooked a clump of hair. They gave it a pull. Suddenly, a pssst. We looked down and saw that the antenna was smoking. The anchor was smoking. Even the cable itself was smoking. And not just smoking, but hissing poisonously like a rattlesnake. Well, the pilot, never mind that he was a lieutenant, quickly figured out what's what, dumped the cable and hightailed it out of there. There it is, their cable, hanging down almost to the ground and covered with hair. We glide slowly to the end of the street. At the bend, Kirill looks at me. Should I turn? I wave him on. Go to lowest gear. Our boot turns and drifts in lowest gear over the last few feet of human land. The sidewalk's getting closer and closer. There's the shadow of the boot inching over the brambles. Here's the zone. And instantly a chill runs down my spine. I feel it every time, but I still don't know whether it's the zone greeting me or a stalker's nerves acting up. Every time I figure I'll go back and ask others if they feel it too. And every time I forget. All right. So we're drifting peacefully above the abandoned gardens. The motor under our feet is humming steadily and calmly. It doesn't care. Nothing can hurt it. And here, my tender cracks. We don't even make it to the first market before he starts babbling. You know, the way novices babble in the zone. His teeth are chattering. His heart is galloping. He's out of it. And though embarrassed, he can't get a grip. I think this is like diarrhea for them. They can't help it. The words just keep pouring out, and the things they'll talk about. They'll rave about the scenery, or they'll philosophize about the aliens, or they might even go on about something totally irrelevant. Like our tender here, he started in on his new suit, and now he just can't shut up about it. How much it costs, and the fine wool it's made of, and how the tailor changed the buttons for him. Be quiet, I say. He gives me a sad look, smacks his lips, and goes on again, now about the silk he needed for the lining. Meanwhile, the gardens are ending. We're already above the clay wasteland that used to be the town dump, and I notice a breeze. There was no wind a moment ago, but suddenly there's a breeze. Dust clouds are swirling, and I think I hear something. Quiet, asshole, I tell Tender. No, he just can't shut up. Now he's going on about the horsehair. All right, no help for it then. Stop, I tell Kirill. He stops immediately. Quick reaction. Good man. I take Tender by the shoulder, turn him toward me, and smack him hard on his visor. He slams nose first into the glass, poor guy, closes his eyes and shuts up. And as soon as he quiets down, I hear crack, crack, crack. Crack, crack, crack. Kirill is looking at me, jaws clenched, teeth bared. I hold up my hand. Don't move, for God's sake, please don't move. But he also hears the crackling and, like any novice, feels the need to immediately do something. Go back, he whispers. I desperately shake my head and wave my fist right in his visor. Cut that out. For God's sake, you never know which way to look with these novices, at the zone or at them. And here my mind goes blank. Over the pile of ancient trash, over the colorful rags and broken glass, drifts a tremor, a vibration, just like the hot air above a tin roof at noon. It floats over the mounds and continues, cuts across our path right beside a marker, lingers over the road, waits for half a second, or am I just imagining that? And slithers into the field over the bushes, over the rotten fences toward the old car graveyard. Damn these eggheads. A great job they did, ran their road down here amid the junk, and I'm a smart one myself. What on earth was I thinking while mooning over their stupid map? Go on at low speed, I tell Kirill. What was that? God knows. It came and went, thank God. Shut up, please. Right now you aren't a person, got it? Right now you are a machine, my steering wheel, a lever. At this point I realize that I might be getting a case of verbal diarrhea myself. That's it, I say. Not another word. Damn, I need a drink. What I'd give to take out my flask, unscrew the lid, slowly, deliberately put it to my mouth, and tilt my head back so I could pour it right in. And swirl the liquor around and take another swig. I tell you, these spec suits are a piece of shit. I've lived for years without a spec suit. Lord knows, and plan to live for many more, but not having a drink at a time like this. Ah. Well, enough of that. The wind seems to have died down, and there are no suspicious noises. All we hear is the engine humming steadily and sleepily. Meanwhile, the sun is shining, the heat is pressing down. There's a haze above the garage. Everything seems fine. The markers are floating by us, one by one. Tender's silent, Kirill's silent. They are learning, the novices. Don't worry, guys, even in the zone, you can breathe if you know how. Ah, and there's the 27th marker. A metal pole with a red 27 on it. Kirill looks at me. I nod at him. And our boot stops. The fun and games are over. Now the most important thing is to stay completely calm. We're in no hurry. There's no wind, and the visibility is good. Over there's the ditch where the slug kicked the bucket. You can make out something colorful in there, maybe some clothes of his. He was a lousy guy, rest his soul. Greedy, stupid, and dirty. That's the only kind that gets mixed up with the vulture. Those the vulture Burbridge spots a mile away and gets his claws into. Although, to be fair, the zone doesn't give a damn who the good guys and who the bad guys are. And it turns out, we gotta thank you, slug. You were an idiot, and no one even remembers your real name, but you did show us smarter folks where not to go. Okay. Best thing, of course, would be to get to the pavement. The pavement's flat. You can see everything. And I know that crevice in it, except I don't like those mounds. If we head straight to the pavement, we have to pass right between them. There they stand, smirking and waiting for us. No, I'm not going between the two of you. That's the stalker's second commandment. It has to be clear for 100 paces, either to your left or to your right. Now, what we could do is go over the left mound, although I have no idea what's behind it. According to the map, there's nothing there, but who trusts maps? Listen, Red, whispers Kirill. Let's jump, eh? 50 feet up and then right back down. And there we'll be at the garage, eh? Quiet, you, I say. Just leave me alone right now. Up, he says. And what if something gets you at that height? They won't even be able to find the pieces. Maybe there's a bug trap around here. Never mind the pieces. There will be nothing left at all. These risk-takers really get me. He doesn't like waiting, you see, so let's jump. In any case, it's clear how to get to the mound, and we'll figure the rest out from there. I slip my hand into my pocket and pull out a handful of nuts and bolts. I put them on the palm of my hand, show them to Kirill, and say, remember the story of Hansel and Gretel? Read it in school? Well, here we'll have that in reverse. Look. And I throw the first nut. It flies a short way like I intended and lands about 25 feet away. The nut goes fine. Did you see that? I ask. So? He says. Don't so me. I'm asking you, did you see that? Yeah, I did. Now, take our boot over to that nut at low speed and stop 6 feet in front of it. Got it? Got it. You looking for a gravic concentrates? Never you mind what I'm looking for. Give me a second. I want to throw another one. Watch where it falls, then don't take your eyes off it. I throw another nut. Naturally, this one also goes fine and lands just ahead of the first one. Go ahead, I say. He starts the boot. His face has become completely calm. You can see he's figured everything out. They're all like that, the eggheads. The most important thing for them is to come up with a name. Until he comes up with one, you feel really sorry for him. He looks so lost. But when he finds a label, like Graviconcentrate, he thinks he's figured it all out and perks right up. We pass the first nut, then the second and third. Tender keeps sighing, shifting from one foot to the other, and yawning nervously with a slight whimper. He's suffering, the poor guy. It's all right. This will probably do him good. He'll take 10 pounds off today. This is better than any diet. I throw the fourth nut. Doesn't go quite right. I can't explain it, but I feel it in my gut. Something's off. I immediately grab Kirill's hand. Stop, I say. Don't move an inch. I take the fifth nut and throw it farther and higher. There it is, the bug trap. The nut goes up all right and starts going down fine, but halfway down it looks like someone tugged it off to the side, pulling it so hard that it goes right into the clay and disappears. Ever see that? I whisper. Only in the movies, he says, straining forward so far he almost falls off the boot. Throw one more, eh? Jesus, one more. As if one would be enough, Lord, these scientists. Anyway, I throw out 8 more nuts until I figure out the shape of the trap. To be honest, I could have managed with 7, but I throw one especially for him, right into the center, so he can properly admire his graviconcentrate. It smashes into the clay as if it were a 10-pound weight instead of a nut, then goes right out of sight, leaving only a hole in the ground. He even grunts with pleasure. All right, I say, we've had our fun, but that's enough. Look over here. I'm throwing one out to show the way. Don't take your eyes off it. Anyway, we go around the bug trap and climb to the top of the mound. It's a puny little mound. I've never even noticed it until today. Right. Okay. So we're hanging above the mound. The pavement is a stone's throw away, at most 20 paces from here. Everything's visible. You can make out every blade of grass, every little crack in the ground. It ought to be smooth sailing from here. Just throw the nut and get on with it. I can't throw the nut. I don't understand what's happening to me, but I just can't force myself to throw it. What is it, says Kirill. Why did we stop here? Wait, I say. Just be quiet, for God's sake. All right, I think. Now I'll throw the nut, nothing to it. We'll glide right by, won't disturb a single blade of grass. Half a minute, and there's the pavement. And suddenly I break into an awful sweat. Some even gets into my eyes, and I know right then I won't be throwing a nut in that direction. To our left, sure, as many as you like. That route is longer, and the stones over there look suspicious, but it'll have to do. I just can't throw a nut in front of us. And so I throw one to our left. Kirill doesn't say a thing. He just turns the boot, drives it over to the nut, and only then looks at me. I must look pretty bad, since he immediately looks away. Don't worry, I say. You can't always take the straight path. And I throw the last nut onto the pavement. Things get easier now. I find my crack in the pavement, which still looks good, isn't overgrown with weeds, and hasn't changed color. I feel happy just looking at it, and it takes us all the way to the gates of the garage, better than any markers. I order Kirill to take us down to 5 feet, and I lie on my stomach and peer into the open gates. At first, I can't see a thing, just darkness, but then my eyes adjust, and I see that the garage seems unchanged. The dump truck is standing over the pit, just like before, in great shape, without any rust holes or spots, and the stuff on the floor around it also looks the same. That's probably because there isn't much hell slime in the pit, and it hasn't splashed out since my last visit. Only one thing worries me. Something silver is sparkling at the back of the garage near the canisters. That wasn't there before. Well, all right, let it sparkle. We aren't going back because of that. It's not even sparkling in an unusual way, just a tiny bit, mildly and almost gently. I get up, dust myself off, and look around. Ah, and here the trucks parked on the lot. Really, just like new. Since I've last been here, they've gotten even newer. While the gasoline tanker, poor thing, is now completely rusted through and about to fall apart. And there's the tire lying beside the gates that you can see on their map. I don't like the looks of that tire. Something wrong with its shadow. The sun is at our backs, but the shadow is stretching toward us. Oh, well, it's far away from us. Anyway, everything's fine. We'll manage. But still, what could be sparkling there? Or am I imagining things? Now, the thing to do would be to light up, sit down quietly, and think it through. What's that silver stuff above the canisters? Why isn't it also beside them? Why is that tire shadow like that? The vulture Burbage was telling us something about the shadows which sounded strange but harmless. The shadows do funny things around here. But what about that silver stuff? Looks just like a cobweb. What sort of spider could have left it behind? I've yet to see a single bug in the zone. And the worst thing is that my empty is lying right there, 2 steps away from the canisters. I should have just taken it last time, and I'd have nothing to worry about. But the damn thing is full, so it's heavy. I could have managed to lift it, but to drag it on my back at night, crawling on all fours... Yeah, if you've never carried an empty, go ahead and try. It's like lugging 20 pounds of water without a bucket. Well, should I go in? I guess I should. A drink would sure help. I turn to Tender and say, Kirill and I are going into the garage now. Stay here with the boot. Don't touch the controls without my permission, no matter what happens. Even if the ground below you catches fire, if you chicken out, I will find you in the afterlife. He nods at me. Seriously, don't worry, I won't chicken out. His nose looks like a plum. I really gave it to him. I carefully lower the emergency ropes. Take one more look at the silver stuff. Wave at Kirill and start to climb down. I stand on the pavement, waiting for him to go down the other rope. Take it slow, I say. Don't rush. Don't raise dust. We're standing on the pavement. The boot is swaying next to us. The ropes are wriggling under our feet. Tender is sticking his head over the railings, looking at us with despair in his eyes. We have to go in. I tell Kirill, walk 2 steps behind me. Keep your eyes on my back and stay alert. And I go in. I stop in the doorway and look around. Damn, it sure is easier to work during the day. I remember how I lay in this same doorway. It was pitch black. The hell slime was shooting tongues of flame up from the pit. Blue ones, like burning alcohol. And the most frustrating thing was that the damn flames didn't even give off light, but only made the garage seem darker. And now it's a breeze. My eyes have gotten used to the gloom. I can see everything, even the dust in the darkest corners. And there really is something sparkling there. Silver threads are stretching from the canisters to the floor. Looks just like a cobweb. It might, in fact, be